Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, we have been studying the Mahasakaludayi Sutta. This is the greater discourse to Sakaludayin, Sutta number 77 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And last time I started to discuss the section number 5 in the sutta, that's Roman numeral 5, on page 636, the section called The Way to Develop Wholesome States. And this very large section begins with 7 groups of factors, which are traditionally called the 37 aids to enlightenment, the 37 bodhipakkhya dhammas. And the 37 bodhipakkhya dhammas are organized into these 7 sets. And last time I spoke briefly about the 4 foundations of mindfulness, or the 4 establishments of mindfulness, and the 4 kinds of striving, the 4 kinds of right effort. And now we come to the 4 bases for spiritual power. These are called the 4 iddhipadas. Well, you have this already on the sheet, so I don't have to write it on the board. Okay, so reading from the text. And here the text that uses standard stock formulas. In paragraph 17, again, Udayan, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the 4 bases for spiritual power. Okay, what are these 4 now? Here, a bhikkhu, a monk, develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to Venerable Nyanamoli used the word zeal. I have to say I don't really like that. I prefer to use the word desire. The Pali word is chanda. Okay. Concentration due to desire and determined striving. I think now I use volitional formations of striving. It's padana sankara. He develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to energy. This is virya, energy, and determined striving, or volitional formations of striving, volitional formations of effort. He develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to, the text has actually citta, mind. Nyanamoli had put in brackets purity of mind and determined striving or volitional formations of striving. And he develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to investigation and determined striving or volitional formations of striving. And thereby many disciples of mine abide, having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Okay, so what are these four bases for spiritual power? The Pali expression is called iddhipada. I wind up putting it on the board anyway. Okay, the iddhipadas with the Pali expression iddhipada, it's a compound made up of iddhi. The word iddhi has a special meaning in Indian spirituality. It comes to take on the meaning of being the kind of supernormal power that one acquires through the higher development of the mind, the kind of spiritual power that builds up in the mind and that can be used to perform, we might call it, miraculous feats. That's looking at it from a worldly point of view, feats that seemingly defy the laws of natural laws as we are familiar with them. And we see this use of the word iddhi and the common expression in the text iddhi vida, the different kinds of supernormal powers that a monk who has mastered the jhanas is able to perform. We come across them later in the same sutta. The ability, for example, to multiply one's body so that one appears simultaneously with different bodies in the different places. The ability to fly through the air without having to purchase a plane ticket. The ability to walk on water, to dive in and out of the earth, to pass through walls and mountains without hindrance. But in the Buddha, of course, the Buddha has incorporated these into his teaching. But he also says, and there's a whole chapter of the Samyutta Nikaya dedicated to the iddhipadas, the spiritual powers, or to the iddhipadas, the basis for spiritual power. And he says that the highest use of the spiritual powers, or the highest use of the iddhipadas, is for the attainment of the liberation of the mind, the permanent, taintless liberation of the mind. Okay, so iddhi has the sense of spiritual power. And then pada, the word pada means literally it's a foot. I think in Chinese it's translated iddhipada tongzu, is that the translation? Shenzu. So zu is foot. Okay, so foot here is to be understood as a basis, the things that constitute the foundation for acquiring and exercising these higher spiritual powers. And the Buddha says that all of those ascetics and monks who have exercised any of these higher spiritual powers, whether they be the mundane spiritual powers, the so-called magical or miraculous powers, or the ultimate spiritual power, that is the liberation of the mind do so through developing and perfecting these four bases for spiritual power. And if we look at the four bases for spiritual power, we see that there are certain things that are common to all of them, and there's one factor which differentiates them. Okay, what is common to all of them? If we look at the formula, first, they all have samadhi, concentration. So concentration is a necessary condition for spiritual power. And then how is this concentration achieved? One common factor, the factor that's common to all of them, is what is called Padana Sankara. This is translated here as determined striving. But in some suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya, which give a detailed analysis of this expression, or of the iddhipadas, the padana sankharas, these determined strivings or volitional formations, volitional activities of striving, are explained exactly as the four kinds of right striving that we discussed last week. That is number two in our set of the 37 aids to enlightenment that we have in paragraph 16 of the sutta. Okay, so these four kinds of striving, four right kinds of striving, called here volitional activities of striving or determined striving, that is necessary in each case for developing that concentration which becomes the basis for spiritual power. But then the other factor that brings this concentration, that is what distinguishes the iddhipadas into four types. The four differentiating factors are what is here called zeal, or I prefer desire. Then the second is energy, virya. The third is citta, or mind. And the fourth is investigation. An investigation is generally understood to be the activity of panya, or wisdom. Wise investigation. I'll write these four terms in Pali for those who are studying Pali. And I have to say that the way this is translated here, that there's already some interpretation, because in the Pali, it all just comes, the definition of each iddhipada just comes as one very, very long compound, which actually goes from almost one side of the page, almost from the left margin to the right margin. It's, for example, the first one is Chanda Samadhi Padana Sankara Samanagatang. That's all one compound. The compound itself doesn't show the grammatical relationship between the different terms in the compound. So when we translate into English, unless you want to translate very literally and put an unintelligible compound in English, one has to put some interpretation into it. But also with the aid of suttas and the Samyutta Nikaya, which explain the Yadipadas, we could understand the sense of the compound. Oh, wait, so, okay, so we can understand that in the first case, there is a desire. And this is not, often we hear that Buddhism condemns desire and says desire is a bad thing to be given up. That's not really the case. What Buddhism says to give up is tanha, craving or selfish desire. But this is a wholesome desire, the desire to achieve some kind of spiritually exalted state. And so some person will make that desire for the goal, desire for that higher achievement, that will be sort of the driving force of that person's endeavor. And so by making desire, giving prominence to desire, that desire for the accomplishment, desire for the goal, this person makes the effort, achieves powerful samadhi concentration, and through that samadhi is able to exercise the spiritual powers, and eventually by combining that samadhi with the higher wisdom, gains liberation. Somebody else might give prominence to energy. This would be a person of strong, of great strength, great energy, great vigor, who makes that energy the sort of vehicle or means of progressing. And in this way is able to gain samadhi through energy. Another person through working on the, of course, all of them are working on the mind, but the person who gives prominence to mind, I would understand to be a person not so, that doesn't have that strong, vigorous, determined effort of the first two types, but who works more on relaxing the mind, calming the mind, making the mind tranquil, clear, bright, pure, radiant. And then through that radiance of mind, cleansing the mind through a very, we call a soft and gentle approach, is able to gain concentration and then use that concentration as the basis for the higher achievements. And then the fourth person, or the fourth basis for spiritual power, is that which is utilizes investigation, which we could understand here. It's not, as I see it yet, the wisdom which investigates the three characteristics, but it might be the investigation into understanding what factors are hindering the mind, what factors promote the unification of the mind. Or it could be that a person here is driven by this desire to understand truth, desire to investigate and to understand the nature of reality, the real nature of things. And through that drive to understand, that thirst or for the experience, the realization of truth, that becomes the motivation for developing concentration. And then that concentration becomes the basis for spiritual power. And it says that these four qualities of energy, of desire, energy, clarity of mind, and investigation, these become the basis for accomplishment, not only in the spiritual domain where one is working to achieve the spiritual powers, but for success in any field, even in mundane spheres. If one is to achieve success in one's work, one does so through desire to achieve some results, through making effort, applying strong energy to one's work, developing a clear mind, a gentle, relaxed mind, receptive, open, responsive mind, and then through proper investigation, examination. Okay, the way these four bases for spiritual power, how they come to their culmination, that we will see later in the sutta. But if there's any questions that just relate to what I explained just now, please feel welcome to ask.
Does the samadhi mean entering into jhanas?
Definitely. For developing these spiritual powers, it would be that samadhi would be at the level of the jhanas.
I read that there's a fifth power of enthusiasm.
Yeah, that is mentioned in one sutta.
I know which one.
It's 16. It's something which is added on.
It's also there in the Chinese one.
He develops the four bases for spiritual power. This is in sutta number 16, paragraph 26. And then here it's given as enthusiasm, usohi, I think, is the fifth. Yeah, but it's mentioned as a fifth factor. For gaining enlightenment, for attaining the supreme security from bondage, but it's not developed as a fifth iddhipada parallel to the others. It's just added as a fifth factor that leads to success.
What is the relationship of the word siddhi to iddhipada?
Siddhi. I see, this is the Sanskrit word siddhi.
That's also a.
It's very close. It's just in Pali, the word siddhi doesn't come to be used. And iddhipada, or iddhi, is Sanskrit or hiddhi. They both mean. Iddhi is from ijati, which means to succeed, to be prosperous, to prosper. Siddhi is from sijati, which also means to succeed. They both mean to succeed, literally to succeed. They were originally at some early time, perhaps coming from the same word, which somehow branched off in two different directions. But they basically have a very similar meaning. Okay, then let us go on now to the next topic within these 37 aids to enlightenment. These are the five faculties. Okay, so here in paragraph 18, the Buddha says, again, Udayi, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the five spiritual faculties. Here, a bhikkhu develops the faculty of faith. This is faith, which leads to peace, leads to enlightenment. He develops the faculty of energy, the faculty of mindfulness, the faculty of concentration, the faculty of wisdom, which leads to peace, leads to enlightenment. And thereby, many disciples of mine abide, having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Okay, these five faculties are a fixed group which again comes repeatedly in the suttas, and we have a whole chapter devoted to them in the Samyutta Nikaya, Sutta number 48, chapter number 48. And if you look just down below at paragraph 19, you'll see that we have five powers. Here, this is a different word from in Iddhipada. That's the word Iddhi, but these five powers are five, the word is Bala, five powers, five strengths. And if you look at them, you see that the factors, the qualities, are exactly the same as the five faculties. So we could take them together. Again, Udayi, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the five powers. Here, a bhikkhu develops the power of faith, which leads to peace, leads to enlightenment. He develops the power of energy, the power of mindfulness, the power of concentration, the power of wisdom, which leads to peace, leads to enlightenment. And thereby, many disciples of mine abide, having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge. Okay, so these five mental qualities, or five mental factors, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, are classified in two ways, or function in two ways, as faculties, indriyas, and as powers, balas. So we have to see, why have two sets? Why classify them, speak about them in two ways? Okay, now I'm going to treat the faculties and come back to what I just wrote. We could understand the faculties by seeing how the word is derived. The word is derived, indriya, derived from the word Indra. Indra was the name of one of the Vedic gods. In fact, in some ways, the chief god in the Vedic pantheon. In the Buddhist text, Indra becomes known as Sakya Devanaminda, Sakya, the king or ruler of the gods. Okay, so the word Indra suggests being a chief, being a ruler, being a governor. And so an indriya is a particular spiritual capacity considered from the standpoint of exercising rulership, controlling influence, or you might say governing influence in a particular domain. And so we have the faculty of faith. And here, faith is not subscribing to articles of belief, a code of fixed doctrine put out by the Buddha or by Buddha's prelates, but it means having confidence or trust in, especially in the enlightenment of the Buddha and in the teaching, the Dhamma that flows from that enlightenment. And so one places trust, confidence in the Buddha's enlightenment, in the teaching flowing in that enlightenment, and faith thereby functions as a faculty in that it exercises the controlling influence of, for example, directing one onto the spiritual path taught by the Buddha. Again, it continues to exercise its controlling influence in keeping one committed to that path despite different obstacles that might come up, different barriers one might face, different questions and doubts one might face that arise in one's mind. But faith is the faculty, faith is the factor that exercises that controlling influence of, you could say, of orienting one's life towards the practice of the Dhamma, towards pursuing the goal of enlightenment taught by the Buddha. And keeping one fixed in one's conviction, commitment to the path, despite all the obstacles, all the barriers, all the doubts and questions that might arise. Okay, energy is a faculty in that it exercises a controlling influence, a governing influence in combating and overcoming its own opponents, its own opposites, which you could say is heedlessness, laziness, negligence. And so energy is what keeps one, or energy is the faculty which exercises its influence by enabling one to apply the four right strivings. These four right strivings are manifestations of energy, applications of energy, but it is this faculty of energy which is functioning in these four ways. And these four ways are, on the one hand, dispelling and overcoming laziness, negligence, and they are enabling one to prevent the unarisen, unwholesome states from arising, to abandon the arisen, unwholesome states, to arouse or develop the unarisen wholesome states, and to stabilize and perfect the arisen wholesome states. Okay, the faculty of mindfulness is a faculty, but let's say the mental quality of mindfulness is a faculty because it exercises a governing influence in its own domain. Its domain is the domain of keeping oneself aware, cognizant of what, say, in day-to-day life, keeping oneself aware, cognizant, mindful of what one is doing, preventing one's mind from drifting away. When one is attending to a meditation subject, it is mindfulness which enables one to keep the meditation subject constantly in mind, and which prevents the meditation subject from slipping away from the mind, which prevents the mind from drifting away from the meditation subject. So we could say that the function of mindfulness as a faculty is to combat, to overcome forgetfulness, obliviousness, mental drifting. Or more positively, it is the function of the faculty of mindfulness to keep the mind constantly aware, constantly alert, continually cognizant of whatever one might be doing when one is applying mindfulness in day-to-day life and when practicing formal meditation, to keep the mind constantly aware of the object without drifting and slipping away. Okay, concentration. Samadhi is a faculty because it exercises a governing influence in its domain. And its function as a faculty is to combat and to overcome mental distractedness. The movement of the mind to many diverse objects, the scatteredness of mind, or more positively expressed, it's the function of the faculty of concentration to keep the mind continually, constantly focused one-pointedly upon the selected object. When one is practicing serenity meditation, samatha meditation, the faculty of concentration keeps the mind focused one-pointedly upon that single, simple object that one has chosen as the object of concentration. And also in practicing insight meditation, one needs the faculty of concentration in order to keep the mind focused one-pointedly upon the continually changing flow or stream of formations, phenomena, conditioned phenomena arising and passing away. The faculty of concentration keeps the mind fixed upon the stream of sankharas, formations, continually focused upon them so that one can observe them steadily, continuously, with unbroken attention. Then the faculty of wisdom, the panyindriya, it exercises a governing influence, a ruling influence in its particular domain. And that domain is the domain of, you could say, right understanding, correct understanding. And so the faculty of wisdom has to exercise rulership in combating its own big obstacle, its own particular barrier, and that is the barrier of ignorance, delusion, wrong views, distorted understanding. And more positively approached, more positively expressed, it is the faculty of wisdom that exercises the function of investigating, examining, and discerning the conditioned phenomena in order to perceive their true characteristics, characteristics of being dependently arisen, being impermanent, unsatisfactory, and non-self. And then it will be wisdom that eventually penetrates through to the unconditioned and realizes, understands the Four Noble Truths. And so, even though I spoke almost as though these five faculties were somehow functioning independently, but that is just a manner of speaking. But we see that all the faculties are described as leading to peace. This is upasama. That is, really it's the higher peace, the peace of Nibbana, and leading to enlightenment. This is sambodhigami, leading to full enlightenment. So all the faculties are really cooperating, functioning in unison, each contributing its own share in that common task of eliminating and overcoming the various obstacles to achieving this peace, to achieving enlightenment, and each contributing its own share in the task of making the breakthrough to that higher peace, to the realization of enlightenment. Okay, now these same mental qualities that are called faculties because they exercise rulership or governing influence from one angle, when they acquire a certain degree of strength or call it indomitable power, then become called the five powers. The Pali commentaries say that the word bala, power, should be understood in the sense of unshakable, unmovable by their opposites. So faith becomes a power when it is unshakable, unmovable by its opposite, that is, disbelief or doubt. Energy can be called a power when it becomes immovable, unshakable by its opposite, laziness. Mindfulness becomes a power when it's immovable, unshakable by its opposite, which is this mental drifting, obliviousness, forgetfulness. Concentration becomes a power when it's unshakable, immovable by its opposite, which is mental distraction, mental scatteredness. And wisdom becomes a power when it's unshakable by its opposite by ignorance. But the way I would understand it, that a person who's developing these five faculties, five powers, at some time he could have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom develop to an extent where they're really powerful, and so we could call them powers. But at a later time, his energy, say, could slack off, he might become lazy, he could become unmindful, he could have some trouble with concentration, his understanding, his wisdom could become clouded. So I would say, perhaps even for somebody called a seka, that is one in the higher training, it's possible for the five powers to go into a state. They never lose them, but they could be upset at times when they're not really engaged in earnest training. But when they arouse these five, when they really start arousing their mind, and then these five qualities come up and become very powerful, so that they cannot, during that period of practice, become disturbed by their opposites, then we could call them five powers. Okay, now I'll ask whether there's any questions concerning the five faculties, five powers taken together.
I've read Bhikkhu Bodhisarva's book, Wings to Awaken.
Yeah.
Can you refer to these as cyclic, where wisdom could lead into increased faith and increased energy?
That is very true. Yeah. The five, I wouldn't say simply cyclic, but they're interwoven, interdependent, so that they're always interacting with each other in many complex ways. So any one gains strength can influence the others. But I should add that there's special emphasis upon acquiring a certain balance in the faculties. This is especially in the early stage of development. And of the five faculties, four of them are placed into two pairs of qualities which have to be balanced against each other. This, I believe, comes not from the canon itself, but from the commentaries, but I think it's quite a useful idea. Okay, one pair is faith and, I don't like to say wisdom, but panya in the sense maybe of intelligence. The other pair is energy and concentration. And now if faith is not properly balanced with panya, with intelligence, understanding, or wisdom, then the faith can easily turn into just blind faith, devotion, just emotional devotion, and emotional piety, and eventually it will just come to, call it a dead end. You have a person who is very exuberant, religiously devout, very pious, likes to go to religious rituals, ceremonies, but the person doesn't have any understanding of the principles of the Buddha's teaching and doesn't think often you see in Buddhist Asia, a person doesn't think they have any chance of developing that capacity for understanding in this life. They think, I just don't have the capacity, I don't have enough merit, I have to do hundreds and hundreds of pujas, flower offerings, candle offerings, leads to the increase of intelligence, offering lights. That's what the Hansus tell us, the monks tell us. Offering lights leads to increased intelligence. So we'll go have an offering of 100,000 candles, 100,000 oil lamps in Anuradhapura. But have open the book to study the Dhamma, 10 minutes. Sleeping. Okay. The other extreme, also you have the person, I can't say a person who's really developed panya to a high extent, but the person who has, I call it a pseudo-panya. Person studies the text, knows many sutras by memory, maybe they have many references to the commentaries, and they delight in going to lectures, discourses, sometimes to show off their knowledge, or if somebody is giving a lecture, they like to get into arguments and say, Venerable Sir, in this sutta, doesn't it say this? So how can you say that? And so they use their knowledge just for the sake of arguments, debates, or for showing off, and that becomes a kind of dead end. And that's because the person, though they might profess to have faith, but that faith is not really a motivating force for spiritual practice, but it's just to say they have a kind of traditional faith which induces them to learn the text, but really they like to get into arguments and to exhibit, make an exhibition of their knowledge. And so we have to balance faith and wisdom, faith and understanding. And then the other two qualities that have to be balanced are energy and concentration. If there's too much forced energy without sufficient calmness, serenity of mind, then that will lead to restlessness. Or a lot of intense effort which doesn't bring the fruits of true samadhi, true concentration, or true wisdom. But that intense effort will just bring a very stiff and rigid mind, and eventually the person will often just burn out and give up. And the opposite of that, again, I can't say that this is real concentration, but we say it's a pseudo-concentration. It's the person who just likes to sit very quietly, softly, maybe play a little of this, they call it like New Age music in the background, light some candles, burn some incense, and sit quietly in a dark room. Think that they're quieting the mind, and just sit there and think, this is meditation. So they can tell people, yes, I'm a meditator, I'm doing meditation. But they're not really making any effort to focus the mind upon a meditation subject, but just sitting quietly, letting the mind drift. And again, that's not fruitful. In a way, I'm presenting these types somewhat as caricatures. Even at the higher levels, there can be sometimes a little too much effort, a little too much calming the mind without enough effort. So at each point, at each stage of development, there has to be a balancing of concentration and energy. Any more questions on the faculty's powers?
I'm trying to understand the difference between a faculty and a power.
Yeah.
Would you say that a power is a perfected faculty? And so how does it
I wouldn't say this that it's perfected, because the faculties come to perfection, I would say, only with the achievement of liberation, arhatship, enlightenment. The power is still being exercised by one on the path. But I would say that it's referring to that particular mental factor, be it faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, in the sense that that factor has reached a degree of strength so that on that occasion it's not shakable, not movable by the opposite qualities.
But on that occasion, so then on another occasion it might not be as strong.
I would understand it in that way. Up to a certain point, at a certain point I would think it becomes, you could say, unshakable. Completely unshakable. But even, say, a once returner, say, can have sometimes lack of mindfulness, lack of concentration. Even an anagami non-returner, sometimes the wisdom can be not yet perfected. Okay, and the faculty is that quality exercising those functions as I explain them. Those functions of combating the opposites and directing the practice towards the achievement of its own particular, of that goal that's appropriate to its own particular domain. Venerable Mario, did you have?
Yeah, Bhante, the description of mindfulness and concentration as faculties and powers, the description you gave, they sound fairly similar to some extent.
Mm.
I was wondering how can we kind of, because in my practice I feel that these are actually quite different qualities.
Yeah.
How would you describe the difference between them?
Yeah, I would say that sati, mindfulness, is what I say, it's a continual recollection. It's a recollection in the present of the object. A constant remembering to keep the object in mind. That is, if one is doing the formal meditation or in day-to-day life, the continual remembering to keep one's mind engaged with what one is doing, not allowing the mind to drift. Whereas the faculty of concentration is that which sustains the attention on the object. And which focuses that attention on the object. Perhaps you would have something to add that might be useful.
No, I was just wanting to explore that a little bit. Yeah, I like the idea of this recollection, this memory nuance in sati. In samadhi, I have this feeling that, you know, like when in the passages, it always says, chitta samadhyati ekuti uti. This idea of oneness.
Yeah.
Samadhyati is to bring together.
Yeah.
And I feel that I can be mindful, that is what I was on the Saturday lecture, there was a discussion, I can be mindful of a variety of things, but I cannot be concentrating on a variety of things. That is my basic feeling. What's the difference? I mean, I'm talking about concentration in the sense of indriya or bala.
Yeah.
I can concentrate only on one thing. So, I mean, I also don't know about that. This is just my feeling. My practical flavor is concentration is a state where the mind becomes unified.
Yeah.
It's a oneness.
Yeah.
Mindfulness is not necessarily a oneness. Mm. It can also be variety as long as I'm present.
Yeah, that is so. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a good point. Except I would say that in insight meditation, the object is constantly changing. So there's not just one object, as in samatha meditation, but the mind is still fixed, you would say, one-pointedly on the object, in that it's not distracted.
So would this be now the mindfulness, or would this be the concentration? I mean, I know we can completely separate them, but the flavor is more the mindfulness.
I would say this is the function of concentration. Yeah. Because there's a difference between distraction and forgetfulness. When one becomes forgetful, that's the opposite of mindfulness, then distraction sets in. When one loses mindfulness, distraction sets in. So mindfulness contributes towards concentration. But, let me see how to put this. But concentration concentration sustains the attention on the object and doesn't allow the mind to shift away from the object, shift onto other things. Okay, mindfulness is the continual recollection, remembrance to keep the mind on the object. And it prevents the mind from drifting away from the object. So in a way, this mindfulness is functioning as a supporting condition for concentration. I want to get through I'm not going to go into details with the Bojangas because I went into them. And I just have to mention the most important thing in these pairing up the faculties in these two pairs of opposites, that the fifth faculty, mindfulness, here has the function of overseeing the balance between the two pairs, of seeing that faith and wisdom are properly balanced, that one doesn't outstrip the other, and seeing that energy and concentration are properly balanced, and one doesn't outstrip the other. And so in this way, the faculty of mindfulness becomes the regulator in the relations between the other four faculties. Okay, the seven factors of enlightenment I explained just in the previous sutta that we did. This was the Anapanasati Sutta. So, please refer to your notes, your recordings of that. I won't go into this. The Noble Eightfold Path, again, I'm not going to go into a detailed explanation, because we did the Noble Eightfold Path last semester, when we did the discourse on the Great 40, but I'm going to take the Noble Eightfold Path in relation to the faculties. Okay, we have right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And thereby many disciples of mine abide, having reached the consummation perfection of direct knowledge. Now, I want to show how there's very close interrelationship between all of these seven sets with their 37 aids to enlightenment. Like, when we see the seven sets, one might think that the seven sets are somehow separate sets to be cultivated on separate occasions. And in fact, I saw in some of the texts of like scholastic Tibetan Buddhism, they speak about how in one aeon or one aeon, one has to perfect the four satipatthanas. In another life or another aeon, one has to perfect the four right strivings. Another aeon, one perfects the four bases for spiritual power, like that. But actually, these 37 aids to enlightenment are interwoven, and in many cases it's actually the same mental quality or mental factor functioning in different sets and just called, labeled differently because it belongs to the different sets. So taking the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the most comprehensive of these seven. Okay, we have right view, right intention. I would see these now, so they're usually identified with the wisdom group, but I see these as actually even preliminary to the faculties, not yet included in the faculty of wisdom. But this is establishing the right conceptual right view through study of the Dhamma, hearing the Dhamma, reflecting on the Dhamma, clarifying one's perspective, one's understanding, and gaining the right intention, the right motivation. Then one undertakes the three ethical factors, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Those factors not mentioned in any of the other sets, but that's part of the Buddha's broadest scheme of spiritual development, and so it comes into the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, then when one undertakes the training of the mind, okay, and this whole practice of the Noble Eightfold Path is undertaken through faith or confidence, especially when one clarifies one's view, then one gains confidence, and through confidence one develops the right intention and undertakes the three ethical factors. So even though faith is not mentioned in the Noble Eightfold Path, but it underlies it, it's sort of implied in the background. And then through that faith, which is the faculty of faith, one takes up the training of the mind. And what is the training of the mind? But it is the practice of the right effort applied to the practice, or it is applying right effort to the training and right mindfulness. So it is the actual practice of mental development is this balance, or you could say this interaction of right effort and right mindfulness. Or phrased differently, it is right effort applied to the practice of right mindfulness. So this brings in the faculty of energy and the faculty of mindfulness. And as one energetically practices right mindfulness, these four foundations, one is through right effort, one is developing the four right kinds of striving. That is the second set in the 37, the second set of the seven sets. And right mindfulness, of course, is the four foundations of mindfulness, the four establishments of mindfulness, which is the first set among the seven sets. And right effort is the faculty of energy, right mindfulness is the faculty of mindfulness. And so one develops these two faculties of energy and mindfulness, and as the mindfulness develops, it leads into samadhi, concentration, and that becomes right concentration. And that right concentration is the faculty of concentration . And to the extent that this energy, this mindfulness, this concentration are unshakable by their opposites, we can also call them powers. Perhaps, I'm not sure yet. Okay, but this right concentration is not yet the end of the path, even though it's the eighth factor of the path. But one uses this right concentration as a basis for examining the nature of phenomena, to look into, investigate the five aggregates, the six sense bases, dependent origination, the four noble truths, and then one gains insight into these principles. Especially one sees the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, non-self. And going deeper, one penetrates into the Four Noble Truths. That brings the higher right view, which we now can call the right view, which is penetrating wisdom. And that becomes the faculty of wisdom. And when the faculty of wisdom is operative, at this point, I think we can say that we have the five powers, the five bullas, now working together. And we could bring in also, if you look at the seven factors of enlightenment, you see we have the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is none other than the four establishments of mindfulness. I take the investigation of state's enlightenment factor as the second enlightenment factor to be a preliminary wisdom. But eventually, as the seven factors of enlightenment mature, that will become the faculty of wisdom. Then we have the energy enlightenment factor, that is the four right strivings. The concentration enlightenment factor is the faculty of concentration. In this way, we could see that there's a great deal of overlapping and interconnections between the 37 aids to enlightenment. Okay, now I will stop the presentation and ask if there's any questions on anything. We'll just take a few questions. Dr. Murray?
I'd like to ask you to comment again on how right speech, right action, and right livelihood connect with the topic of tonight's lecture.
Well, the topic of tonight's lecture is, the general topic is that the Buddha taught the way to develop wholesome states, and the first group of wholesome states that the Buddha taught, here are the 37 aids to enlightenment, which are the seven sets. And the seventh of those seven sets is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path includes right speech, right action, right livelihood. of the seven sets, the first six are mainly concerned with what we call mental faculties. But the Buddha's path is a broader path. It's not just concerned with mental faculties, but with the whole way of life. And so I think this is why the Buddha usually, when he explained the way to the cessation of suffering or the way to Nibbana, he formulated that way as the Noble Eightfold Path because it's more comprehensive. It applies to a person's entire life. It includes areas not covered by the other six sets, not explicitly covered by the other six sets. And so for that reason, he includes right speech, right action, right livelihood, which are expanded in many other discourses of the Buddha that deal with ethics. Okay, any further questions? David.
How come on the there are all these subsets of those that there are all of these things you need to know to be enlightened? It doesn't really seem to mention anything about loving kindness in general as an energy or as a
Yeah, I understand it that these 37 aids to enlightenment are most of them are the factors that are concerned sort of directly with developing the mind for the perception of ultimate truth. And so loving kindness is not a factor which enters directly into the training for the perceiving of ultimate truth. But loving kindness, we could say, would be implicitly included in the broader scope of the Noble Eightfold Path under right intention. And it certainly underlies such factors as right speech, right action, right livelihood. Okay, we're going to have to stop now because it's getting late. So we end by sharing the merits with all of the devas, the nagas, the buddhas, and all other beings that can witness this, wishing that they will be well, happy, and will protect the Buddha's teaching. Akasata chabumata devanagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata devanagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata devanagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mantaram. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe satanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya.